Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good evening and welcome to the Independent Republican Mike Graham. You're with Talk, we're on TV, we're on radio, we're online, and of course we're on your smart speaker as well. Coming up, actress Rebel Wilson claims a member of the royal family invited her to a drug-fueled orgy at the home of a US tech billionaire. The former chief inspector of prisons warns our overcrowded jails are a tinderbox that could ignite at any time. And of course, it's St George's Day. Not that our patron saint would recognise the England of today. I'll give you the facts behind the flag. Good evening, Britain, and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham, right here on Talk TV. England is a country with plenty to boast about, and what better time to celebrate its successes than today, St George's Day. But celebrating St George's Day doesn't seem to be particularly British these days. We'll discuss that later on in the show. Plus, if you end up in hospital in a serious condition, apparently you're less likely to die if the doctor treating you is female. And speaking of doctors, one's been struck off for participating in a peaceful Just Stop Oil protest. Some people don't think it's fair. I think it is. This is the Independent Republican Mike Graham. On your marks, get set, let's start the show. Now, it's another day of recoiling for members of the royal family as an Australian actress, Rebel Wilson, has claimed a person in the firm invited her to a drug-fueled orgy at the home of a US tech billionaire in 2014. In her new book, the pitch-perfect star says the male member of the royal family, who was 15th or 20th in line to the British throne, floundered around at the party where drugs were being passed around like sweets. Strange story. We've got the host, of course, of the To Die For Daily podcast, live from LA, Ms. Kinsey Schofield. Kinsey, what a delight to be talking to you about something other than Harry and Meghan and Kate and William and all the rest of it. I mean, this is a very odd story. I'm not even sure if it's true. What are people saying about it over there?
I'd like to clarify a few things. Number one, I did not have talking about a royal rebel orgy with Mike Graham on my 2024 bingo card. Number two, I am not an orgy expert, but I love talking about the royals. So that's what I'm here to do today. And this is, of course, in her new book, Rebel Rising, which has caused so much controversy. I just realized today that Sacha Baron Cohen, who had a post, has so much power that her book was postponed in both Australia. It was postponed until the beginning of next month. UK, it was postponed until I don't know when. And he actually had the portion about him completely removed from the UK. So that is how, that's how salacious this book has become. And she says that, you know, that this is somebody kind of on the fringe of the royal family, 15th to 20th in line. People are, of course, shocked. It's on the cover of TMZ, page six. All of the big, you know, entertainment news outlets, people love this story.
They do. But, of course, it's one of those guessing games that you can never really get right. And, I mean, we would not be in any position whatsoever to ever cast aspersions of any kind on anyone in particular. But we can tell you who it's probably not, I suppose. It's probably not Prince Andrew, because it's too far removed from him. It's not Prince Harry, too far removed from him. It may well be one of several many less plumed people, shall we say, who have been 15th or 20th or even 40th to the throne. But speculation, I suppose, doesn't matter at this point, because if you're not naming anybody, you don't have to worry.
Right. Well, legally, she's probably in the clear. You're absolutely right. Now, Rebel does have a history with Prince Harry. She showed up at one of his polo events in Santa Barbara, and there was a really glowing exchange between the two of them. And it was kind of when the Sussexes were in a lull. I mean, when are they not? But it was kind of when the Sussexes needed some Hollywood sparkle. They needed some support from Hollywood. So it was great that she showed up. But months later, she actually told Bravo's Andy Cohen that Meghan was ugly to her. And Meghan was not nice to her when she asked about the children. So we know she does have a relationship slash history with Prince Harry. It seems like she gets along well with Prince Harry, but not necessarily Meghan. But will royals distance themselves from Rebel going forward? Probably yes.
Well, we've had situations like this in the past, which have been a bit more serious, actually, where television individuals, television personalities have been in the frame for something that might have happened. You might remember going back to the Hugh Edwards story with the BBC. Mm-hmm. There were an awful lot of BBC stars who ended up having to come out and say, sorry, it's not me that this person is being talked about. You know, I don't suspect the royals will do that. But Peter Phillips is an interesting one. He comes in at number 18. He's known to quite like parties. I'm not suggesting for a minute that it's him. I'm just saying that, you know, when you look between 15 and 20, there's not much there, really. I mean, Princess Anne is there. You've got the Lady Louise Mountbatten Windsor. I don't think it's probably her. You've got people like the Duke of Edinburgh when he was still alive. Back then, he would have been 14th in line to the throne. You know, there's no name really that sort of jumps out at you. Freddie Windsor's another name that a lot of people have mentioned, but he's way down the list at sort of 40th or something. But he was known to be a bit of a party boy as well.
What we're doing right now is what the internet's doing. And I mean, people are going to come to their own conclusions and they're going to be convinced that it's somebody specific. But you are right. I do think that it's part of their strength, part of their weakness, never complain, never explain. It will be in their best interest not to engage in this story and make it even bigger. They're hoping it'll go away and they're hoping that people will just move on to the next scandal.
Yes. It's got a kind of pantomime feel to it a little bit as well, because, as you say, you're not an expert in orgies, neither am I, but apparently, according to her memoir, it was a tech billionaire's party which had a theme of medieval clothing. She decided to get dressed up in a buxom damsel outfit, complete with a cone hat. Men were jousting on horses in a field, girls dressed as mermaids in a pool. I mean, I've never been invited to any parties like that. Sorry.
And I actually feel like such a loser after reading that paragraph. Like, honestly, what am I doing with my life? But we should stress that she did not partake in said orgy. She was still a virgin at the time and decided that that just wasn't the way she was willing to lose it. And you know what? I give her a high five for that, because that sounds like the worst story ever.
Yes. But, I mean, it does, I suppose, give you a bit of an insight into how Hollywood was still like that. Or certainly California was still like that in those days. It may not be anymore. Maybe it still is. But, you know, these are the days of the Playboy Mansion and Hugh Hefner parties and all sorts of other stuff.
Before Me Too. I think that's a great point. This is before everything kind of changed and everyone now walks on eggshells and is so concerned about the way they behave. And, I mean, what's crazy is these things are coming back to haunt people years later.
Exactly. Shall we talk about something that we can look at and identify? And that is the birthday picture, which people thought they weren't going to see, but which they eventually did see, even as people were arguing about why the picture hadn't been released by the Prince and Princess of Wales. We get the sixth birthday of Prince Louis. There he is.
Oh, so sweet. And, you know, I just think I did talk to Katie Nichols about this. I said, do you think that this is something that we might see going forward, a change of protocol? And she felt like maybe this was just circumstance. But it's, you know, from my point of view, maybe a change of protocol is okay. Maybe the Prince and Princess of Wales are setting some boundaries and they're saying, you know what? Everything's going to be on our terms now. Mm. If you're going to question us and if you're going to try to publicly humiliate us over a photo, then we're just going to release them on social media and you're not going to have access to them. And that, you know, that opportunity and that privilege is gone. And if that's the way they want to do it, I think good for them, because I thought that the first few months of 2024 for them were a nightmare from hell. And I really sympathize with them there.
Absolutely right. Kinsey, stay where you are, if you wouldn't mind. I was going to bring in broadcaster barrister Andrew Eborn and broadcaster Candice Holdsworth. Welcome to both of you. Well done for coming. Now, my first thought when I looked at that picture today was, just please don't have changed it or edited it in any way or done anything to it. Is it just a straightforward picture? Because otherwise the world will go mad again.
No, absolutely. And then to be fair to Kate, I mean, the previous photo which she released, all she was trying to do was make it look as good as possible.
Yes.
It wasn't like a photograph with F-A-U-X, you see what you did there. That the reality was, and if you look back at royal photos, they've always done that. You had the Queen with all the grandchildren.
Yeah.
That was clearly edited in a particular way. William, he wasn't smiling enough at Sophie and Edward's wedding.
Yeah.
And therefore, he was photoshopped in with a smiling one. This happens
all
the time.
The facts don't matter, though, when the nutters get hold of this stuff. So, you know, you just want to make sure that it was a straightforward picture.
Yeah.
And it's a lovely picture.
It's a glorious picture. There was never any ill intent in the previous ones either. But it's a lovely picture. He's looking wonderful, Louis.
Yeah.
And all credit to him. We need some good royal stories to balance the rebel one.
It is sad that they've now got this adversarial relationship with the big photo agencies.
Yeah.
And I did think that Getty was just being a little bit overly harsh when they were saying these photos may have been edited. I mean, like, as if they were creating deepfakes.
Like, tampered with.
Yes.
But to be fair on that, the policy, just to be clear on the agencies, is that you cannot have manipulated... They all say that in their terms and conditions. So you cannot manipulate a photo, and that's what they say to their clients. These are not manipulated in any way.
Yeah.
So what didn't happen in the media is that clear explanation.
Yes.
Well, they turn around and say, oh, it's a fake, and because it's a fake, this is all fake news, and so on and so forth. It wasn't fake news. Mm. It worked on that sort of premise. And I think getting that clarity is important.
Yeah. And Kinsey, just coming back to you, that would mean, presumably, they're not going to release these pictures to agencies anymore. They'll just put them out on their own, as you say, on their own social media.
I guess we'll have to wait and see. I thought that perhaps they were making a statement this time around and that they were... I think that maybe they're just changing their boundaries and trying to set new expectations, which is very fair after really the public asked for so much more than they were owed over the last few months.
Yeah. And I said we weren't going to talk about Harry and Meghan, but we are now because, obviously, you know, once they've released a picture like that, which is lovely, I mean, there'll have to be some kind of retaliation, won't there, from Montecito?
I mean, maybe it's going to be raspberry jam tomorrow. Who knows? Meghan is full of surprise.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of negative news coming out of Montecito that Meghan's podcast has been postponed because the podcasting company just doesn't want to have to compete with Netflix and some of her other PR excursions like American Riviera Orchard. You know, Tom Bauer writing this new piece saying that there are more bully allegations on the horizon. So it's not a good time to be in Montecito, California right now looking at this glowing picture of this little boy because not a lot of good news coming out for Harry and Meghan.
And Candice, let me come to you because the King has recognised public service of his family in a new list of honours, including creating a new role for Kate, the Princess of Wales. She's going to be the Royal Companion of the Order of the Companions of Honour, which is going to be a mouthful.
So many companions.
But, you know, it sounds good. And also, the Queen is going to be given something new to do as well. So they're obviously trying to kind of move it all on, aren't they?
They are. And I think things are going to be different now. I think after these two very serious bouts of illness. And I think also dealing with, you know, what seemed like a good idea, a slimmed down monarchy, but which has actually turned out to be a serious hindrance.
Yeah.
Yes.
They're going to have to rethink things and they're going to have to be more pragmatic and think on their feet more and not necessarily have fixed ideas. And, you know, Kate, I'm sure we're all hoping and praying Kate pulls through this and there's good news. But it's going to be a long recovery.
Mm, yeah.
And she's going to go into remission and she's going to have to be monitored for many, many years.
Right.
And she's going to be a different person. She's going to have to take things at a different pace.
Mm. What's going to be really interesting, it's Archie's birthday on the 6th of May, which is obviously the anniversary of the coronation.
Yes.
You might recall that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see how they play.
And how old is he going to be?
I think he's going to be six, isn't he?
Six as well.
Five.
Five. No, you're right. He's five. 2019. He worked on that basis.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he's five.
Nobody's really seen many pictures of him.
No.
Kids, have they?
They've kept him. So it'd be interesting to see what they do there and in response, I think, on that sort of basis.
Yeah, absolutely. And Kinsey, as far as what happens going forward with Charles, we wait to see what he's going to do. And we're expecting to see him, we think, at the Derby, right? He said he's going to be turning up for that, I think, I read somewhere. So what's the American market looking for the royal family at the moment?
Yeah, and Katie Nicholl reporting today, too, that we expect him to start... he wants to get back in front of people as early as next month because he's so frustrated that his... You know, treatment has taken so long and he is eager to get back in front of people and to shake hands and just to be busy and be out front again. The American public is very concerned about both the Princess of Wales and King Charles, and you are seeing that same discussion about the slimmed-down monarchy, and you are seeing almost critical discussions about how they handled the last few months, which is frustrating as somebody that is such a royalist to see that American commentary. But I do know that they are eager to see both the Prince and both the Princess of Wales and King Charles back on hitting the roads and back on the engagement route, and that they are concerned for their health.
Yeah, absolutely. Kinsey, great to see you. Thank you very much indeed. Kinsey Schofield there. And thank you both to Andrew and to Candice as well. We'll be back with both of you coming up. We've got some breaking news, though, right now. Coming through from The Sun in the last hour, two unnamed teenage Premier League footballers have been arrested this weekend after a rape was reported to the police. One 19-year-old player is suspected of rape and the other, also 19, of assault and aiding and abetting a rape on Friday night. It's been reported that both players have now been released on bail pending further inquiries. We might have more on that when we bring you the papers later on as well. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Up next, despite the Rwanda bill passing through Parliament last night, the boats show no sign of stopping with deadly consequences. And now, a quick reminder that Talk, the home of common sense, is going digital. Make sure you're ready. From next Monday, you can watch live on YouTube and listen to Talk on radio via DAB or through your smart speaker. We'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Just hours after the Rwanda bill came into law, the French Navy escorted a packed migrant dinghy across into Britain, despite five people tragically dying as they made the treacherous journey. And now, after 2 years of wrangling over Rwanda, it begs the question, will the Prime Minister's strategy of deterrence actually work? Joining me to discuss all of this, Deputy Editor for The Sun, Deputy Political Editor of The Sun, Ryan Sabey, broadcaster and journalist Emma Wolfe, and barrister and broadcaster Andrew Ebor. There he is, the man himself. Welcome to all of you. You've been here already once. So we were here last night, slightly went off air slightly before it all went through the House of Lords. I mean, I saw people saying today, Ryan, so the House of Lords is effectively now officially useless, which is probably a bit harsh, but, I mean, all of this surely could have been done quicker and, you know, made into law more than a month ago.
Yeah, well, it could have been, but I don't think that's the House of Lords' fault. I think it's the government's fault. I think they said this is emergency legislation 5 months ago. They could have got the legislation done and dusted before Christmas. You remember, go back to before Easter.
Yeah.
They didn't push the legislation before the MPs and peers went away for their Easter break. They could have done it then. So they talk about the emergency legislation. They haven't acted as if it's an emergency. And part of the reason for that, I think, is they're trying to get all their ducks in the row. They're trying to get the airfield in place. Yeah. They were trying to get the flights. They were trying to get the judges. They were trying to get all the caseworkers. And they didn't quite have that.
But have they got it now, though?
But if we take Rishi Sunak at his word, and he said at that press conference, he stood there in Downing Street and he said that they're all ready to go. So and I think it's going to take 10, 12 weeks. You've got to work out whether they're going to have any legal challenges. They seem to think they've got 150 cases that are actually legally watertight.
I'm not sure about that. I mean, Emma, I don't have confidence that they've got this.
Well, his body language was interesting at that press conference as well, because he looked as though he was a man who finally got it past the line, didn't he, and work on that sort of basis. But I think...
But he can't believe that, Emma, can he?
I think he has to believe it.
Is your name Emma?
Five promises.
Is your name Emma?
He's not. Oh, I'm sorry.
He's answering when I say Emma. That means I want her to answer me. Emma, please.
Well, no. I mean, look, he's become utterly fixated, almost like a man possessed about getting it through. Mm. So finally, he's got it through. Is there any link between stopping the small boat and this ludicrous Rwanda plan? I don't see the link. It is not a deterrent.
Right.
This is not. Last night, this morning, we saw five people have drowned, including a 4-year-old child.
Yeah. And I thought the most significant thing about
him
that
trying
was,
to
was the number of people
out.
On the boat, 100 people on a boat.
And Sunak trying to make out that this, that his emergency legislation finally going through is somehow compassionate. It's going to stop small boats. No, if you put a fraction of resources that have been hundreds of millions of pounds that have gone into this farcical legislation into actually stopping people where they were, or dealing with their problems where they were, instead of having them cross, you would have saved lives. So I just don't see the link.
There's 100 people on this boat.
Yeah.
Now, seeing as this accident happened at sea,
some
of them went back to France.
Right.
The others went to the UK. Yeah. This is how desperate these people are.
But this is what happens, though.
It's not a deterrent.
But they will carry on doing it.
Yeah, of course they will. Andrew?
No, but I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the pictures they show in the press, however, it doesn't look like 100 people on one of those sort of boats. So it is interesting to look at that sort of side. Whether it's a deterrent or not, as you say, Rwanda at the moment can only process 200 people anyway. So that's why they're looking at Costa Rica and various other places to make that make sense. What has to happen, as we always say, is the focus needs to be on the people traffickers. Get the message to them that we're actually after you and we're going to try and deal with that.
Yeah, but that's not going to work, is it? Because you might as well say to drug dealers, don't bring drugs into Britain because we'll put you in prison. They know that already. They still do it because the money is so huge.
This is part of Labour's big idea. They are going to go sort of upstream and they're going to try and find the people smugglers. How are you going to, you know, getting British police work with the European police, you know, really closely? I don't know if that's going to work and be successful.
Well, all of it's been tried, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we've given them money. Rishi Sunak hasn't thought of that.
Right. And also now that we've got the UN talking to, you know, separate sort of commercial organisations saying if you do take part in this kind of effort, like if you fly people to Rwanda, you know, you may well be breaking international law.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they're throwing their tap and take me worth it as well.
Yeah, you look at the airlines. I mean, it seems like it's been really, really hard to try and find some airlines to actually... to take these migrants to Rwanda.
Right.
So much so that the government have been saying they've got really robust plans. And part of that robust plans, it seems like they may well have the RAF on standby just in case some of the planes may not...
Well, exactly right. And the immigration minister, I think Tomlinson, was on a TV earlier on today saying that they haven't... He was asked directly, have you actually got cases that you can now deport?
Yeah.
And he didn't seem very sure. He wasn't sure if they'd actually got a list. He wasn't sure if people had been processed and then refused. They don't seem to be prepared for it at all, it seems to me.
No, and exactly, and you don't have... It's not as though you have people on small boats being taken off the boats when they land and put on flight. Yeah, no. I mean, you know, that isn't a deterrent in that way because they know what will happen.
Yeah.
The people who are being hand-picked, it made it sound like an exclusive kind of guesswork.
Yeah, yeah.
The people who are being hand-picked, the 150 or so, will be from the backlog.
And where are these people?
You know, who are they? Where are they?
Yeah, and I mean, if they are going to be taken out... Are they being taken out of hotels? Are they being taken out of holding areas, of you know, ex-army camps? Are they in accommodation in flats and houses?
I think legally it's going to be very hard to actually... Those people who, you know, once this law gets royal assent in the next few days, I think what they may try and do is anyone who then comes over, they will be, I hate to say the phrase, but the guinea pigs of the people who may be taken, they may be detained, because once they get into the community, they will just disappear.
And you can guarantee what's going to happen is the press around that. Sunak has to have that victory. His five pledges, he's got to get at least one person there to Rwanda. And I think that will happen.
I think that would be just pathetic, though.
I think that's even worse.
It's even worse. We've got
20 people.
Maybe you can't answer this question, but I'm going to ask you, Andrew, you're your lawyer. Presumably, they haven't outlawed legal aid being made available for
you have to
fight deportation.
No,
there'll be a string of lawyers lining
up. There'll be so many last minute, you know, those very last minute death row appeals.
Yeah.
Before they're put onto
that was the
Andrew
as opposed to the Emma, but it was good, but it worked well.
I'm now a criminal barrister.
But you're absolutely right, and that's what they've done. They redefine what's safe, which is the bizarre way of doing it. I always talk about Abraham Lincoln. If you call the tail of a dog a leg, how many legs does a dog have? It's still four, because calling a tail doesn't make it a leg. And the reality is exactly that. So just because they've called it a safe country doesn't necessarily mean that the lawyers can't turn around and say, actually, this person is not going to be safe. There are other laws and regulations which will happen.
Right.
So what they've got to look for is to make sure that there's a certain case that they can get. I do predict, I mean, a definition of spring will probably go into summer, but that's going to be the reality. They will get at least one as a point of principle, and the press around that will be huge.
Mm.
But exactly that sort of thing, lawyers will have a field day trying to stop it.
Well, one of the things that they were arguing about in the House of Lords, I think the last amendment, which they eventually gave up on, was to have something put into the bill which said, if it becomes more dangerous in the future, you know, we'll have to stop sending people there. So there's bound to be lawyers who'll get up in court and say, well, how do we know that it's now safe? Despite the fact that you said it was safe 3 months ago, it might not be safe now. They'll just go on and on with it, won't they?
Yeah, no, sorry. And I think that the trouble is you can have those individual cases and they'll always find a reason. And we had one lawyer on the radio this morning saying that, you know, does mental health come into it?
Well, it will.
How long is a piece of string? Yeah. I mean, one thing is for sure, this has ruined Rwanda's reputation. And as for those other countries you mentioned, Costa Rica and all the other ones that they approached...
Great to begin with, to be fair.
No other country will want to go near... a UK government's deportation scheme in the future. I know Rwanda have made a lot of money out of this thus far. Yeah, take the money. But I don't think they would, if they could go back.
I think
who will ever go to Rwanda now as a holiday destination? No way.
Right.
What about the
sort of political lesson from this? Can we say that we now know there won't be an election in July as a result of this? Will they try and do an election early if they do manage to get a couple of people sent over there?
I think he has to. A plane has to take off, and I think there probably has to be, as he said yesterday, there has to be a regular rhythm of planes going off. And I think the thinking in Downing Street has always been this, looking at a general election in October, November. I just don't think you wouldn't want to go into a general election where you haven't got any planes taken off to Rwanda. You are still technically in recession, and waiting lists in the NHS are still high.
Yeah.
I still think he needs a bit more time to actually get things in his favour.
But it might get worse though.
This
is the trouble. Some people in cabinet have been actually saying you need to go early because it's a damage limitation exercise. You could make things worse by going longer.
Or you can wait until Trump gets elected because you might have a better chance, and that would be interesting.
Yeah, well, who knows?
He is still sort of saying the second half of the year.
Yeah. Yes.
I think that's where the money is, isn't
Definitely.
It?
Definitely, October, November.
Well, listen, we'll come back to all of you very shortly. You're watching the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Up next, British jails are at breaking point with more criminals in our streets than we have space for in our slammers. Overcrowding so bad, they're letting cons out early. So sound the alarm. Welcome back. You're watching the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Now, British jails are a tinderbox that could ignite at any moment, according to former prisons chief Neil Hardwick, with overcrowded conditions leaving prisons vulnerable to riots. Emergency measures are now desperately needed. Only last month, there were fewer than 500 places left in men's jails. Cool, blimey, Governor. With me now is the former prison governor herself, Vanessa Frake. Vanessa, very good evening to you. Thanks very much for joining us on the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. I mean, the only time I ever talk about prisons these days, it seems as though it's in one heck of a mess. The whole system is overloaded, it's overcrowded, there's not enough prisons, there's not enough guards, there's not enough hours in the day to look after everybody. You know, it seems as though very little of the prison service at the moment is doing what it's supposed to do.
Good evening, Mike. And unfortunately, every time I seem to come and chat to you guys at GB News, it's doom and gloom with the prison service. It seems that, you know, all aspects of our prison system is just crumbling away. Yeah. And, you know, you've got overcrowding, you've got lack of staff, you've got poor support for staff, you've got violence, you've got drugs in prison. You know, you've got escapes. The list seems to be, like, endless. And, you know, since 2010, our prisons have been drained of resources. Sentences have gone up of prisoners. So, you know, this all has a knock-on effect. And what we're left with now is a very poor state of affairs where we've got something like 500 places left.
Yes.
And, you know, like Nick Hardwick said, you know, it is a tinderbox. There is a lot more violence these days than there was. There's a lot more drugs in prison. We know that there's allegedly gang members holding lids on prisons by dealing drugs and keeping prisoners quiet. You know, it's a very worrying time because what prisons are for is to punish and rehabilitate. And as far as I can see, there's very little rehabilitation going on.
Exactly
and,
right.
You know, eventually these people will be let out into the community. Mm.
And the problem also seems to be, from Nick Hardwick's perspective, he's saying that the overcrowding levels and the sort of levels of violence and the conditions in general are very similar to what it was like before the Strangeways riots back in 1990, which I remember pretty well, where the whole prison was basically taken over and it took quite a long time to get back control of it.
Yeah, I mean, the Strangeways riots started in the chapel and went on for quite some considerable time before the last five were got down from the roof. You know, they literally had to rebuild Strangeways prison because of the damage that was caused. You know, we are not far away. And again, then there was crumbling prisons, there were shortages of staff, there was no regimes, there was no rehabilitation. There was a lot of overcrowding and we seem to have come full circle again. But, you know, this government since 2010 has just drained the resources out of prisons in one way or another. Right. And now, unfortunately, we're going to pay the price for that.
But one of the problems with prison spaces, I suppose, is that nobody wants a prison anywhere near them, because we've been told for quite a few years now, haven't we, that the government is building super prisons, it's going to build another prison somewhere up in the north of England, it's going to build another one somewhere in the Midlands. None of these things seem to have come to pass. Are there any prisons actually under construction at the moment?
I do believe there are one or two, but to be honest, you know, prisons are their own sort of town almost, you know, behind a wall. You know, there's a lot of prisons. I think that there's four or five main prisons in London in itself, and right. London is a built-up area.
Right.
So there's nothing to be feared from a prison if it's run properly and controlled properly and has all the security measures in properly. Mm. But, you know, this is going to cost billions of pounds. And even if with their building programme, the government reckon that they're still going to be 2,500 prison places short
right.
By March 2025. So, you know, it's a short-term problem. What we need to do is look at sentencing. You know, releasing prisoners early is not the answer, because we're releasing prisoners who are not ready to be released, who haven't got the support, who haven't got the homes, who haven't got the jobs, who haven't got the necessary kudos to be released. So we're releasing them out with nothing, unprepared to go and commit crime again, to come back in. It's just farcical. The yeah. whole service is farcical, and I am very sorry to see it like that now.
And is it so far gone now, do you think, Vanessa, that it can't really be fixed quickly, and it certainly can't be fixed cheaply? I mean, what would you suggest they do?
I mean, no, you're absolutely right, because one of the things is staff. And, you know, we know that there's a problem with recruitment. The wages for a prison officer in London is something like £30,000. Well, you know, what can you do with that? Mm. You know, bearing in mind these people are going into very dangerous situations on a daily basis and expecting to get assaulted. Nobody should be going into work to be expecting to get assaulted by prisoners. There's no quick fix. I think it's gone past that period. You know, I think there has to be a complete overhaul of our justice system. We lock up more prisoners in this country than in Western Europe. We have the worst reoffending rates than in Western Europe. So what does that tell you? It tells you that prison in its current form does not work. Mm. There needs to be a whole sort of multitask group discussion without the political bias that follows prisons, because no prisons minister wants to say, you know, let's look at shorter sentences, working in communities, that sort of thing, because it's not a vote winner. And that's the problem a lot of the time. Ministers don't want to put their heads above the parapet, so to speak.
No, quite. But is there a country we could look to maybe in Europe and say, this is how they do it there, this is how we could do it better in terms of, you know, better recidivism rates and better education and whatever it is you want to give them, training them for jobs, preparing them for life on the outside world. The other thing I hear a lot about is gang life inside of prisons and the way the gangs are kind of running prisons now and recruiting people as they come in.
Well, yes, that is part of prison. You know, that, you know, prison reflects society. In society, there are a lot of gangs, particularly in inner cities. And when you get gang members into jail, then they carry on being in gangs. And so, yeah, there is. And that is quite a cause of issues, drug dealing, violence, that sort of thing. Coercive behaviour in jails. Yeah, absolutely. They are a part of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you had a strong, experienced prison staff to deal with it, that could all be dealt with quite simply. By, you know, splitting people up, by punishments with inside prisons, by taking people to court for dealing drugs or being caught with mobile phones in prison, for bribing and corrupting officers. That in itself is an offence, but you see very little of that. You see an awful lot of poorly trained, inexperienced staff having affairs with prisoners, but you never hear about the prisoner. you know, it would be very easy to put to the Crown Prosecution Service under the Bribery Act of 2010 for bribing an official. And, you know, I think it carries a sentence something like 2 to 5 years to add on. That would also be a deterrent. Norway is a prime example of a prison system that has completely rethought it. They've gone full circle. They used to be like us. They used to lock up a lot of prisoners with short sentences, and then they turn their focus on rehabilitation. And they've had some amazing results. And now where we lock up something like, I think it's around about 146 per 100,000, I think they're on 47 per 100,000. Right. And personally speaking, I prefer my taxes to go on preventing crime than dealing with crime.
Yeah.
You know, none of us want to live in a crime-filled society.
No, I think that's right. Vanessa, good to talk to you. Thanks very much indeed. Vanessa Frake there, painting a pretty grim picture of what's going on behind bars, within these walls, whatever you want to call it. Maybe Norway's the way forward. It's certainly not the way forward to keep locking more and more people up and letting them out earlier and earlier. That certainly doesn't seem to be the way to go. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Coming up, the Islington Glitterati, also known as the Labour Party to you and I, have vowed to tackle rocketing rural crime. Labour goes native, folks. It's all coming up next. Welcome back. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Now it's time for Taking the Mic. Cry God for Harry, England and St George. The last line in the Shakespeare play Henry V is meant to summon up the sinews and prepare us for a battle ahead, a battle not just for our country, but for our very way of life. Today is St George's Day, but it's also Shakespeare's birthday, and it's a day that could not be more English. But can you honestly say that this country feels English at this moment in time? Unlike Ireland on St Patrick's Day, Scotland on St Andrew's Day, or even Wales on St David's Day, you'd be hard-pressed to find any flags of St George being brandished around anywhere. As I told you yesterday, there are still elements of our society who regard that red and white flags to represent racism and division. The Labour Party under Sir Keir Starmer is attempting to rebrand itself as the Party of Patriotism. But beware a leopard that pretends it can change its spots. As we've seen with the anti-Semitic element of the leftists, it hasn't really gone away. But let us for the moment look back at Shakespeare's work. Henry V was written in 1598, and the words quoted above are from Act 3, just before the Battle of Agincourt. Cry God for Harry, says the king. But what of our Harry, an heir to the throne of the United Kingdom who has chosen to flee his birthright for celebrity, fame and blandness in a foreign land, albeit an ally in America? Harry has deserted his family, fallen out with his brother, and now officially calls his main residence the United States. He has been the chief architect, through his rather indiscreet and dismal book, Spare, of the breakup of the royal family. He has damaged its brand around the world, hardly the act of a would-be king. And what about the state of England, a once proud land where boys and men fought foreign foes to safeguard a way of life, to safeguard freedoms, and to build a better world for us all? In England, in 2024, our veterans are homeless on our streets. We are told by leftists that the English way of life is somehow wrong, and that we should embrace other cultures, for they will make us richer. Only today, there are lawyers lining up to undermine our government in their attempts to protect us from unbridled and illegal immigration, hardly something to write a poem about. Our health service is worse than useless. Our infrastructure is creaking. Our prisons, as you've just heard, are full. And our police would rather allow a Free Palestine hate march to go ahead than to protect our hard-won freedoms and the rights of the individual. As for St George, he would probably be turning in his grave if he could see what we have become. He might have slayed the dragon, but there are plenty more monsters lurking in the shadows. And as for the lefties, they tell us he's not really our patron saint anyway. Marvellous, isn't it? Now, earlier today, the Labour Party set out plans for the first ever rural crime strategy to tackle issues blighting communities outside of our towns and cities. The move follows research which revealed the countryside crime rate has surged by 32% since 2011, with a total rise of almost 130,000 reported offences, including almost 30,000 offences of criminal damage and arson. Joining me now is former head of Rural Protection, Di Davis, but that's not why we're speaking to him. It's because he is a former police officer and lives in rural Snow Snowdonia, and Jonathan Roberts from the Country Land and Business Association. Welcome to both of you. Thanks for joining us on the Independent Republic. Di, let me come to you first. I mean, I've lived in rural Wiltshire. I've lived in parts of Britain which are so deserted, the only thing you really see is sheep as opposed to people. But the crime wave has really become something. Tell us what you know about where it's where it is, what it's like where you are.
Well, two of my neighbours I was talking to today, I'm stuck between two big farms. One of them had £6,000 to £8,000 worth of equipment stolen 6 weeks ago. And the other one had an honesty box full of, for his eggs that he sells for the main road. And they smashed into that. They didn't take it once. He reset it. And sadly, they took it again. And there was CCT evidence. But unfortunately, for better or for worse, the police couldn't catch those responsible. It is dire for these people. They have enough to cope with, dealing with various rules and regulations at the moment, including the Welsh government, who want to do all kinds of things to them. I really feel sorry for them. And it seems to me, having done some research into this over some time now, that there seems to be a need for a national coordination between all the forces to tackle this. Some forces are very good, particularly in the northeast. Some are dire. And the problem is there is no real classification to say this happened on a farm or this was rural crime. And an organization has come up with a study saying there needs to be 10 key points. I haven't got time to go through them now, but essentially the police have got to get their act together. The College of Policing have to get their act together and realize this is a crime that's blighting our society, particularly in the rural areas. I can't remember when I last saw policemen in and around this area. And when you do, they're community support officers who have neither the powers to stop and search or do anything else. It's a complete waste. We need real coppers doing roadblocks late at night, stopping many of the people. They know who they are. They come from families going back from 7 to 70. They're just criminals and they get away with it. And as we've heard, the criminal justice doesn't seem to realise that and lock them up for long periods.
No, indeed. Jonathan, let me bring you into this. You're from the Country Land and Business Association. Is that your experience as well, that, you know, a lot of rural areas are just not very well protected in a way and they're not very well policed?
Yeah, and that really emboldens these criminals. And we should remind ourselves, really, we're not talking about petty crime. We're often talking about very seriously organised crime, well-organised crime, committed by smart people who are ultimately, though, thugs. And there is often an implicit or indeed explicit threat of violence that comes with this sort of crime, whether it's stealing millions of pounds worth of machinery from farms, whether it's undertaking hair coursing that they are live streaming to illegal betting markets, often in places like China, and that goes right through to a wide variety of other sorts of crimes as well, down to fly tipping. So until we have enough coppers on the beat and until we have enough people relatively close to the where the crime is taking place, then I don't really see how crime can come down in rural areas. And I take the point about Labour having a new strategy, but, you know, I'm always a little bit conscious of politicians saying that they're going to come up with a strategy at some point in the future. We need that strategy now. We need that coordination now. And we actually need a certain degree of cross-party consensus that rural crime is important.
Yes, exactly right. And Di, let me come back to you. I mean, you've got experience of working within the police, obviously, itself in various different situations. But in terms of rural policing, I mean, is it the fact that we've got all these constabularies that are spread around, you know, different cities, different counties? There's no real coordination, it seems to me. And if you're getting your tractor stolen or you're getting some expensive machinery taken away, obviously it's going to be sold somewhere. There must be a market for it. It must be possible to track where this stuff goes.
Well, absolutely. And it is serious crime. And the serious and organised crime group should get a handle on this, because clearly you're talking millions and millions of pounds worth of property, not just the petty theft that goes on, but stealing Range Rovers, stealing parts to various vehicles, agricultural, this is going on under our very noses. And unless you've got proper intelligence and the structure to gather that intelligence and then translate that into operational activity, you're not going to catch these people. But I say again, there are well-known people and gangs who, from the age of 7 upwards to 70, they know who they are. They do get arrested now and again. They get paltry sentences. Unless we have a deterrent effect, and you've just been discussing prisons, yeah, but I'm afraid to say you can have as many Labour or Conservative strategies under the sun. Unless the police get their act together, and it's fragmented, sadly, in this country, some are much better than others, but we need to get a grip on it. I know there's a shortage, they say, of policemen and women, but equally so, the crime commissioners, they're all coming up for election, they ought to be looking at doing this. It is a priority, as far as I'm concerned, because without farmers, where would we be?
Indeed. I mean, they're all too busy at demonstrations and protests in London, it seems to me, which happen about every 3.5 nanoseconds. But Jonathan, let me come back to you, because it must be an extra cost for an awful lot of businesses rurally who need to get more insurance cover. If they do lose items, they're going to be, their insurance is going to be going up. They might even be employing security of their own. Is that the kind of thing that's happening?
Yeah, well, I think it was around £50 million worth of machinery alone that was stolen last year. And that's before you get into even the sorts of crimes some people would have thought was being historic, like sheep rustling, which is a totaling several millions of pounds now. And that's really when you're talking about farms that are only just viable, they're only just turning a profit. They're seeing their costs go up and they're seeing the prices that they're getting for their produce going down. You know, losing 100 sheep, losing 50 sheep, losing that bit of kit that they've invested in, it's really the difference between that business being viable or not. Now, as Di says, you know, without our farmers, we go very, very hungry very quickly. So, you know, this problem isn't just about farmers, but it is really about land and it's about the isolation of rural communities. And we need to be able to just make sure that we're spreading our police resources appropriately across the entire country. We're spending the right money in the right places. We're putting the right resources in the right places. Hitherto, unfortunately, we hear some horror stories of rural police officers not even having a pair of wellies in the boot of their car, not even having a torch in their car, not being able to undertake some of the basic police work that they'll need to do in a rural landscape. So it's good that we've got, you know, the potential for a strategy now, but that strategy needs to get very granular very, very quickly if it's to have the desired impact.
No, quite. And Di, let me come back to you. I mean, without getting overly political, I mean, the Labour Party are not known for their sort of knowledge of rural matters, are they? I mean, most of their strongholds, certainly in England, are in the cities. I know that you've been blessed with a Labour government over there in Wales for quite a few years now. But do you have any confidence in them understanding the rural needs of the country?
Well, no more than I have about their 20 miles an hour philosophy, which
I
they're going
they
to spend millions
that.
Now. Well, yes, quite. No, the problem is many of them don't represent, and in fairness to Plaid Cymru and others, the Welsh nationalists, at least they have some knowledge of the farming community. I'm not being disrespectful to Labour, but equally so, under the Conservative government, we've had little or no success in tackling these people, aided and abetted by these useless judges we often have and magistrates who simply don't understand, as your other presenter said, the sheer scale of it. And I keep coming back to intelligence, but intelligence is graded information. Mm. Unless forces grade it and there's a national system and structure, and if the Labour Party can do that, it'll be one step further towards recognising the extent. They say 50 to 60 million. I would double that because so many people, if you look at the NFU survey, they say most people are 30% plus don't bother reporting things to
the
police because nobody does anything.
Di, I appreciate your time. I appreciate both of your times. Thank you very much. Jonathan Roberts as well. Di Davis, great to talk to both of you. We've got to run because we are running late, I'm afraid. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Coming up next, Ukraine receives a wad of cash from Congress and statistics show women are more likely to keep you safe under the knife. Really? See you after the break.
Hold up. It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Good evening and welcome back to the Independent Republican, Mike Graham. You're with Talk, we're on TV, we're on radio, we're online, and of course we're on your smart speaker. Coming up, Rishi Sunak announces a £500 million package of military aid to Ukraine, alongside the UK's largest provision of munitions so far. You're less likely to die if a female doctor treats you, with research showing men underestimate the severity of their patient's illness. And using the phrase, back in your day, to an older colleague at work could count as age harassment. We'll get an older lawyer's take. Now, everyone knows there's plenty wrong with crime and punishment in this country at the moment. We have a two-tier policing system that treats different groups of people very differently. And we saw that just today as the Metropolitan Police turned up to face the St George's Day celebrations in London, dressed in riot gear, while at the weekend they were happy to threaten Jewish people with arrest if they crossed the road during a pro-Palestinian march. We've seen them wrongfully arrest Tommy Robinson while allowing terrorist chants and the defacing of buildings, only to film them and investigate later. If anyone ever gets charged by the police, the chances of them ever getting to court are now impossibly long. And if that court date does finally arrive, there's a pretty good chance the prosecution either won't turn up or the witnesses can't be bothered. All in all, the justice system is a shambles. A huge backlog of cases, masses of courts going unused, and a general malaise that is affecting our ability to punish wrongdoers properly. Surely someone can fix the problem, I hear you say. But that would take money, loads of it, say the politicians, and we simply can't spare any more. Well, luckily, there are some clever people out there with some smart ideas. Dame Anne Rafferty is one of them. The former Court of Appeal and High Court judge has been talking to the Times Crime and Justice Commission this week, and she's got a brilliant idea, and like all brilliant ideas, it is beautifully simple. Her answer to the crisis is pop-up courts. She reckons judges of all types can sit in pubs, church halls, schools during holidays and libraries to reconnect the justice system with local communities. There used to be a system of travelling circuit judges in this country, but like many things, it fell into disrepair thanks to COVID and the lockdown. Courts simply ceased to function, with many trying to move online unsuccessfully. Until now, no one has known how to fix it. Dame Anne says this: the community can embrace justice and justice can position itself locally, as it always did and always should do. And I particularly like the idea of local justice being meted out in the local pub. It wouldn't be the first time that had happened either. In the 18th century, jurist Sir William Blackstone called a court of pie powders the lowest and at the same time the most expeditious court of justice known to the law of England. It sat at the Stag and Hounds in Bristol until 1870. And as of now, there are more than 23,000 cases awaiting Crown Court trial dates and more than 10,000 people waiting for a trial for a sexual offence. That's the highest backlog ever. This simple idea could revolutionise the system. Now we just need more prisons and we might start getting somewhere. Now, later on in the show, we'll be bringing you a first look at tomorrow's front pages. But before anyone else, we've got an exclusive look at the Sun newspaper. And they've got this remarkable story that we told you about a little bit earlier on. Rape cops swoop on club's stars and a club stadium. Two Premier League footballers dramatically arrested on suspicion of rape after police swooped on a club stadium on the weekend. Now, as you can see from the piece in the Sun, these arrests happened recently. They happened overnight in the last couple of days. The original arrests were made over the weekend. And what's being said is that one of the players, aged 19, was spoken to on suspicion of assault, aiding and abetting a rape. Sources said he was allowed to leave the stadium after a brief interview before he was formally arrested. That's according to The Sun. The player spent the night in the cells and was later quizzed under caution by detective. So it's a massive story. We'll be bringing you more on that as we discuss the papers later on with the panel, of course, as well. Right now, though, Rishi Sunak has pledged to increase UK defence spending to 2.5% of GDP by 2030, as he warns European allies that the continent is at a turning point. This comes as the Prime Minister unveiled an extra £500 million of military funding to Ukraine, the largest supply of munitions to Kiev for their war effort. And just as their front line collapses, could Britain now be dragged in? Joining me is security expert Mr. Will Geddes. Will, welcome to the Independent Republic. Very much appreciate you joining us this evening. He went out to Poland today, Rishi Sunak, which is obviously sending a message to Russia because Poland is literally the adjoining country to Ukraine. A lot of people are still a little bit unsure about whether we should still be giving this amount of money. We saw the delays that happened in America with the Congress not being too happy, and delaying the payments for a long time. I mean, it's difficult to know how much longer people are going to support this, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a difficult one, Mike, and I think everybody's questioning the amount of money that's being donated, but also the amount of armoury. Now, in our instance, a lot of it is actually weaponry and munitions. That £500 million that Rishi has announced today to Donald Tusk that he will donate, obviously, to the Ukraine war effort or conflict effort is significant. But certainly in terms of the NATO budgets, we are one of the few countries within NATO that is actually meeting the level of investment that is necessary. Many of the countries or members of NATO are not doing so. The US are obviously the biggest contributors. But in addition to obviously our 500 million, there's some 60 billion that Biden is also pledging to Ukraine. And one of the greatest concerns is it coming in raw commodity or is it coming in raw cash? Because there are some serious question marks about the management of any finance, any hard currency, if you like, that is being given to Ukraine and whether that's being appropriated or misappropriated.
Well, that's right, because it's almost impossible to know precisely where all that money goes once it gets to Ukraine. You know, Vladimir Zelensky is very good at touting for the money and he's very happy that he gets it. But there doesn't seem to be a terribly good auditing system going on from either here or the US as to precisely where that money's being spent.
Yeah, no, and I've seen it with my own eyes, Mike, in other conflict zones. I could mention one specific example, which was when I first went into Iraq in 2003, when the Coalition Provisional Authority was first set up to restructure and rebuild Iraq. And there were rooms that I would walk into in the Babylon Palace in Baghdad, where you would see literally pallets of cash. And there were significant amounts of money which disappeared, let's say. And the big question with Ukraine is, how is this being audited, as you very rightly say? And I think the big concern is that how much does this bottomless pit continue to be? And certainly when we look at Putin, now, the budget for NATO is about 380 billion of collective contribution to the budget. When we look at certainly Putin, and in terms of Putin's budget, he's already announced that he's prepared to pay another $100 million himself, which brings their budget up to almost $377 billion. So, you know, you're talking a significant amount of money, which is matching Russia to NATO, and that's concerning.
Yeah, it really is, because it can't go on forever. And it's sort of wiser heads, I suppose, are already starting to make noises about, you know, all wars have to end at some point. They always end in some kind of compromise. They always end in some kind of peace deal. It might not be happy. It might not be pleasing to both sides or even just to one side. But inevitably, that's how they all end. You know, no war really ends any other way.
No, I mean, there's going to have to be concessions. I mean, I've said from the outset, Mike, and this is purely my speculation, it's not that necessarily of NATO or of our government, but I think it's going to come to some kind of concession for the Donbass region to be annexed in a similar way to Crimea. And that is the only compromise where everybody walks away from the table without necessarily losing face. Yeah. I think the concern is that we have Zelensky, which has pushed very, very forward in wanting to ensure that his country doesn't give or concede any part of their territory whatsoever. However, you look at the Donbass, you look at the people in the Donbass, they are very Russian-centric. They operate very much on a Russian cultural level. So to concede that area isn't necessarily going to be losing enormous amounts of face. But Zelensky to concede anything after his very bold rhetoric is going to be a challenge.
Yeah, I mean, could there be, for example, a political solution, which is often the way that these things end up going, where they go to Donbass and they say, look, you know, let's ask the people of Donbass what they want and they have a referendum. I know that, you know, it's a dirty word around here sometimes, but, you know, that might be the way out of it, no?
I think it is. I think it absolutely is, Mike. You hit the nail on the head. Give that region a chance to be able to vote for themselves as to whether they want to do that. I mean, I know some Ukrainians who live in Crimea who are very much lent towards Russia. So hence why that they are somewhat to a certain degree annexed. Then the one thing with Ukraine is it's not going to be compromising its major seaports. Odessa, for example. So at the very beginning of the conflict, the potential loss of Odessa would have been significant because obviously that's where a vast majority of their grain is exported and also a lot of imports are coming to Europe. So, you know, a referendum in the Donbass, that might be a nice neutral way to certainly come to some sort of resolution.
No, exactly right. Now, we mentioned Rishi Sunak being out in Poland today. He's now decided that he wants to raise defence spending to 2.5% of GDP by 2030. I'll ask you in a moment, Will, what that will actually mean in real terms. But let's have a look at what Rishi Sunak had to say.
I believe we must do more to defend our country, our interests and our values. So today I'm announcing the biggest strengthening of our national defence for a generation. We will increase defence spending to a new baseline of 2.5% of GDP by 2030. That starts today and rises steadily in each and every year. Over the next 6 years, we'll invest an additional £75 billion in our defence. And it will be fully funded with no increase in borrowing or debt.
Well, we won't get into how it's going to be fully funded, but what he is saying, basically, is that he wants to put Britain on a war footing. Does he mean that?
Yeah, I think he very much does. I mean, Poland's position is that they're on a pre-war footing already. And Rishi Sunak has to show support and certainly sort of continuity in terms of our increase, our contribution, our obligation, if you like, to NATO. But we're looking at 75 billion, which Sunak has mentioned, by 2030. It's not going to be 75 billion by that time. It's going to increase exponentially to what some economists, and I'm not an economist, Mike, as you know, but they're estimating that figure probably rising to about 85. So there's another 10 billion. Now, much of that money, which is going to be dedicated to defence, and I'm one of the first supporters of increasing our defence standing and certainly our investment, but it will be taking from other parts of the United Kingdom. A large proportion of our GDP defence spending has been attributed, for example, to the NHS. This increase in defence spending could take from the police, the prison services, as you mentioned in your previous piece. It could take from a number of integral basic parts of our country and infrastructure, which could leave them very lacking. And at the moment, they're pretty lacking already.
Well, right. And what would it actually buy? Because I was listening to some analysis just last week about what the problem is with the Ministry of Defence and how an awful lot of our kind of sparse hardware, shall we say, is distributed around the world. You know, where, for example, a British naval ship will be sent to kind of keep an eye on China. But I was told that actually China's got 500 warships. You know, we've got less than 10. And it's really not going to frighten them if we send one of our ships into their, you know, proximity, if you like, to keep an eye on what they're doing with Taiwan. And maybe what we should do is spend less time policing the world, if you like, and protecting maybe more of our own.
Well, again, I agree with you, Mike. We're never going to compare or compete with the United States, for example, who have the largest proportion, obviously, of their overseas personnel generally positioned in the Far East, certainly in Japan, certainly with the emerging issues between Taiwan and China, for that example. Yeah. The other question is in terms of the defence of the United Kingdom, which is really where our focus needs to be. If we as taxpayers are contributing to this defence budget, I think we want to see a return on that investment. And there's a lot of questions that I think need to be reconciled also in terms of foreign aid as well, and whether we need to start reconciling and reinvesting into our own country rather than necessarily giving charity and giving good support to countries around the world that don't necessarily need it quite as desperately as maybe we do.
And that's the thing, because, again, looking at what happened in Israel when all those drone attacks and missile attacks were fired in from Iran, you know, again, I've heard so many commentators who know about this stuff, about the hardware that we have and the protection that we have, that we don't have the kind of protection that Israel has got. And if for some reason some country like Iran decided to fire a few ballistic missiles at us, we wouldn't be able to stop them in the way that Israel could.
Well, we might be able to, Mike, actually, because certainly a little bird tweeted in my ear about how the countermeasures were contributed to, certainly in the Iran strike against Israel. And a good proportion of that was to the GPS system, which was taken down, which is why many, many planes were grounded during that whole situation. It wasn't to avoid necessary munitions flying into Israel. It was because the GPS weren't operating. There are four principal GPS systems operating in the world. One that's controlled by the US, one by Russia, one by China, and one by India. And the US apparently did assist in removing the GPS coverage of that area, making it much more difficult for those precision armaments and certainly missiles to hit their targets.
Absolutely right. Will, good to talk to you. An awful lot to get through there, but we managed to get through it very well. Thank you very much indeed. Will Geddes there on the situation with our defence spending. Now, you better pray you're treated by a woman during your next visit to the hospital, because new research shows patients are less likely to die when treated by a female doctor. And patients generally benefited from having a woman treat them, but the greatest difference was seen in female patients treated by female doctors. Scientists have suggested that the difference could be due to male doctors underestimating the severity of their female patients' illnesses. And now to discuss this, I'd like to welcome Dr. Wendy Gregory. Dr. Wendy, very nice to see you. Thank you for joining us on the Independent Republican, Mike Graham.
Hi, Mike.
I'm one of those slightly sceptical people when it comes to surveys and when it comes to, you know, data gathering. And I always wonder whether they've actually got this one right, because it seems kind of hard to believe, but tell me what the study found.
Well, the study, it was a very large study. The sample was 700,000 patients, so that's, you know, that's normally significant. However, when I looked at the actual stats, the percentage of difference was really very, very small. And also, it was only done on people over the age of 65, so in the vulnerable age group. So I'm not sure, we can't extrapolate from that to younger generations or younger patients. So, you know, that remains an unknown quantity. However, I do think there were some very kind of, well, a lot of it was speculative about the reasons. There were some quite specific ones, but there's also, I think, some more general reasons, some more things that are based on the differences in male and female brains, which the study didn't mention, but of which I'm aware of, which could be reasons. So, there, as you said, one of them was that male doctors may be less sensitive to women's pain and their difficulties. But I think there is a general understanding that often women are better communicators. They're more likely to listen to their patients. So therefore, they're more likely to pick up on something that may or may not be wrong.
Yeah.
Also, quite interestingly, in my research, because I've done quite a lot of research on gender differences in brain development, so between male and female. So males' confidence usually exceeds their competence. And this starts happening from a very young age. It's possibly partly brain difference, partly socialisation. So men are more likely to think they've done a really good job when they may not have done. Women tend to have much more self-doubt. So they're looking to see, you know, have I missed something here? Is there something more I could have done? So to me, that is quite a possible as one of the reasons why this happens. Women tend to be more methodical in the way that they work. And this, again, if you go back to schools, if you can remember when you were a teenager at school, to the teenage, it wasn't very long ago, I know. If you say to the boys, you've got a project due in at the end of February, and you tell them that in November, they would start the project, you know, a week before the end of February. generally, the girls start doing it straight away and they do it methodically. They work out how long they've got and so on. So it's just a different way of working. And you know, I wouldn't necessarily say one is much better than the other, but I think that makes it more likely that female doctors will pick up on issues that patients may have. I mean,
But it's a very broad brush approach, this, isn't it? Because, I mean, what you're basically saying is that, effectively, all women doctors are better than male doctors. And you might not think you're saying that, but that's what it sounds like. You're basically saying that men are overconfident and undercompetent. You're saying that women have more attention to detail, that women are better listeners and all of that. And, you know, some of that may well be the case, but I wonder whether it may well be as well that a lot of women say to me that they would rather be treated by a female doctor because they're able to communicate with each other better. And I think rather than saying perhaps that that men and women are different in terms of the way that their brains work, I wonder whether sometimes when women talk to men, they talk to them in a different way. So when you're talking to a male doctor, you might not be as open as a woman as you would be talking to a woman doctor. And that might also be a factor, no?
Very true, very true. I would never say that male doctors are better than females or females are better than males. That's absolutely not what I was saying. But no, you're quite right. In particular, when it comes to more intimate matters, yes, women. I personally prefer to have a female doctor because...
men would probably be too frightened to say the same thing. But yeah, I think most men would rather see a man if it was about something to do with their body that they weren't happy with, or there was something that was troubling them, or there was an illness going on. I think most men and most women would rather see a doctor of their own sex. No.
Sure, yeah, and I think that's kind of just natural.
Yeah.
It's like if you had to go to the police, I would probably prefer to be seen by a female police officer than a male one, and you'd probably prefer to be seen by a male. I think that's just human nature, really.
Well, you'd be lucky to find one in most parts of the country. So, I mean, yeah, I don't think I'd care, to be honest, but I mean, that's the other issue. And, I mean, in terms of life expectancy, I suppose, is the next one, isn't it? Because, I mean, is it not the case that women, generally speaking, live longer than men? So that also might be a factor in some of this stuff, you know, because it might be that men are dying not necessarily as a result of an operation, but just because they were going to die sooner anyway.
Well, I think that they would have taken that into consideration when they were doing the results of this study, because, I mean, they would obviously know that. But it was quite specific. It was within a certain time frame. So after an operation, I can't remember exactly how long it was, but I think it was like 3 months. They're more likely to die if they've been treated by a male doctor. It's 3 months after the operation, and also to be readmitted in 30 days or less. So it was a very specific time frame. It wasn't just, you know, the next 10 years or so.
Right. And so, I mean, what can we learn from this particular study? As you say, it's a very large study. Will it be taken seriously by the medical fraternity? Will they look at it? And I mean, one of the things that people tell me as well is that doctors can be incredibly arrogant. I mean, and I don't know whether that is different for men and different for women, but an awful lot of doctors are accused of being rather, you know, uncaring, shall we say, and a bit too sort of matter of fact sometimes when they deal with patients. Is there a gender difference in that as well?
I think that there possibly is. I know you're not going to like me saying that, but yes. And what can we learn from it? I don't think we can really draw huge conclusions from this study. I think further research needs to be done. As I said, it was only done on patients over the age of 65. Yeah. Might not apply to younger patients at all. Who knows? So I don't really think we can draw conclusions from it.
Right, because it's a bit like, I mean, I've been told many times that you've got more chance of dying if you happen to go into hospital at the weekend than if you go during the week.
That's true.
Because it happens to be, you know, less populated by doctors and, you know, some of the specialists are not around. So, you know, there's an awful lot of sort of, shall we say, unknowns in here, aren't there?
There are unknowns. There really are. I mean, it's also, and this is a fact, but I'm not sure anyone is absolutely... sure why you're more likely to bleed to death if you're operated on when it's a full moon than if it's a crescent moon. So.
Wow. You see, now that really isn't... That's the most worrying statistic of all that you've come out with tonight. I have to make sure you don't go in for an operation when there's a full moon. But listen, great
especially
to talk
not
to you.
A major one.
Yeah. No, absolutely okay, right. Dr. Wendy Gregory, thank you very much indeed. We shall pore over it, I'm sure, for months to come and see whether there's anything we can take from it. Now, if you haven't already heard, Talk TV is going digital next week. Here's how you can watch, how you can listen, and how you can get involved from Monday, the 29th of April.
Very good morning to you.
Thanks for joining us.
The home of big opinions.
Oh, don't start me on that.
Straight talking.
There's a sort of feeling they ought to look as if they're doing something.
And no nonsense.
So don't accuse anyone else of stoking culture wars.
Is going digital.
Such as the smoke and mirrors of politics.
Make sure you're ready.
But the government's got to be more flexible.
From the end of April, listen to Talk on Radio via DAB or your smart speaker. Or watch live on YouTube on your connected TV.
You are watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Chaos again on St George's Day as clashes erupt between marchers and police, while Jeremy Hunt has egg all over his face over his tat cut. We'll be back in a mo. Welcome back. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. It's St George's Day today, of course, but I don't think St George would have been very impressed with the scenes at an event in Whitehall today when a group of attendees clashed with the police. As you can see, there was always going to be a group of people who were going to go to Whitehall to have their celebration. It's an annual event. They always do it, and it always turns into something that it shouldn't turn into. If you were watching a bit earlier, you can see the police kind of trying to kettle the people that came down. The Metropolitan Police actually also, before it all happened, issued a statement in which they said, "We believe that some of the people coming to this event are coming from football clubs and right-wing groups and are probably now going to be causing trouble." And as you can see at one point at the end, a horse actually gets whacked on the nose with an umbrella. And it's all very tedious. It also happened to coincide with Tommy Robinson being in a court today in which he was found to have been arrested unlawfully and in which he basically won against the police. And so it all kind of comes together. We'll talk about it in a second. The panel's back with me. Andrew Eborn is here, Candice Holdsworth, Emma Wolfe as well. Welcome back. Thank you very much indeed. I mean, St George's Day is one of those days, a bit like International Men's Day, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where men always say, "Why isn't there an International Men's Day?" when there's an International Women's Day. And they go, "Well, there is." And they go, "Oh, right, OK, then." And it's St George's Day. It's a bit similar. I mean, I've said a couple of for the last 2 days, there is a certain part of Britain that seems somehow ashamed to be to be English. You know, you can wave a salt iron in Scotland, you can wave a flag St David in Wales, you can wave a tricolour in Ireland, but in England it's not really the done thing to wave a St George's flag.
We should take pride in our glorious country, and we shouldn't. Basically, if people are looking for offence or they're looking for trouble, it's basically it will spark it, won't it?
But a lot of complaints came in from people on the right, and you know, a lot of people don't agree with many of the people who are doing this demonstration today. But there's no question that the police treat them differently to the way that they treat, you know, Black Lives Matter, which is the way that they treat, you know, the Palestinian marchers when they come through London. They deliberately look for them and try and push them around. And they weren't all just men who'd been in the pub, you know, dressed as crusaders. And there was a lot of women there. There were some kids there as well. The police have a problem in London dealing with what they perceive to be right-wing protesters.
I know. I think the thing that I don't like about it is the snobbery directed towards people.
Yeah.
Who wave the St George's flag. I mean, there's sort of this, like, it's seen as a low status
thing. Yeah, you're considered to be some kind of knuckle dragon.
Yes. And, you know, Emily Thornberry really revealed New Labour's contempt for the working class when she took that picture of someone with a St George's flag.
In Rochester, Kent,
yes, you know, and it just showed how far they'd actually strayed from their roots.
And Keir Starmer's desperately trying to get that back now. I mean, he gave a little video today in which he talked about how, you know, the St George's flag was for everyone and, you know, he's all for Britain and Labour's now the party of patriotism.
Yes.
Well, that's news to most people, I think, Emma, isn't it?
And Labour were right out of the blocks at about 7 o'clock this morning tweeting their St George's flag.
Yeah.
It's been a bit of a fight back, hasn't it?
And
suddenly all the kind of right-on people are saying, you know, we're proud of being English.
Yeah.
But why should we feel apologetic
for
being proud of being English? Not even British, just English with our St George's flag. It's so strange, isn't it?
I know. It's very strange.
Not
now, here's
far
something
right,
else
and
strange.
It's not racist.
Yeah. No, exactly right. Now, I've been asked to seek your guidance on this,
Andrew.
Oh, yes, please. In your capacity as an older lawyer.
Lawyer?
Yes.
Is that right?
Because apparently if you use the word back in your day
to
an older work colleague, it could be age harassment.
Well, absolutely, in the same way.
I mean, I just had it from a woman doctor who was talking to me there about how you're better off being treated by a woman doctor because you're less likely to die.
Well,
she said to me, "I don't know whether you can remember your school days." I mean, I could take that I could take that very badly. Well, if
exactly.
I
well, I remember when in primary school.
I remember them very well. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. The reality is this, and it's all happening at the moment. We had somebody very recently where they remember he was in his 60s, yeah, and he was offered a chair.
Right.
And they turned around and said, "Hang about, that's ageist."
Ageist.
And, on that sort of basis, you've had somebody turning around where they say, "Don't play the race card with me,"
right,
and they turned around and said, "That's the thing." The problem with all of this, it devalues real prejudice.
Yeah.
And when you get taking it too extreme, it's working on that sort of basis. So I think it's okay to say back in my day.
Do you guys care?
No, geez. I mean, you just have to be way more resilient.
Yeah.
I cannot stand this fragility culture now. Where comments, but you know that comments that everyone would have just thought of as completely innocuous, you know, 10, 15 years ago. And now I think it's this growth of this sort of HR bureaucracy.
Yeah. Yes.
And it's got to find purpose for itself. It's got to find meaning for itself. And so it creates problems where there aren't really any problems.
Well, the microaggressions are now listed, aren't they? So that if you go and join a company, these are things you can't do or can't say.
And it started with
terrifying to even open one's mouth, isn't it? No, I do think, though, in ageism, I'm glad that this is being highlighted. I think there's a lot of casual ageism around, which people don't realise can be quite offensive. It can be. But then there's real ageism, and that should probably be, the resources should be devoted to actually dealing with that. The fact that if you're over 50, it's very, very hard to get a job.
Or
the fact that women are obviously subjected to ageism, really, obviously.
So real prejudice needs to be called out, but it's this artificial. Yeah. And it's about intention. For me, it goes back to the things like, where are you from?
Yeah.
Was not meant to be a racist statement.
No.
And you work with Lady Hussey.
But also as a woman, I guess you've also been through this where it might have been thought to be innocuous, but, somebody sort of treated you like the little woman, you won't know about this because it's cars, or you won't know about this because it's numbers, and you might be very good at that. People used to do that too, which probably wasn't a good thing.
Well, but I'm also quite old-fashioned.
But it still goes on. It still goes on. The other day at a different station, not this station, I was introduced as a journalist, and the man and I've written 10 books.
Yeah.
The man next to me, who's written one book, was introduced as a writer and author and journalist and broadcaster. And I wouldn't have said anything, but it's just little things like that that women do still experience. That kind of won't know about it, or they'll always go to the man on politics or tech.
Yes,
and they won't, and they'll go to the woman on health stories.
And that's wrong.
Touchy feely.
But the fake outrage when you get things when people out of common courtesy. I was brought up. You open doors for ladies, for your seats, and
really,
so on.
That's
so
lovely, open doors but that's for everyone.
I do that. I open doors for both of you, and some people take offence at that. Yeah. And I think that's so unfair.
But that's their problem, isn't it?
Yes, because you don't take
offence. But that's aggressive. No. Why would you take offence at someone being polite, whether they're a man or a woman?
But even when I'm walking somebody on the road, I would stand where the on the side of the traffic to protect them. That's the old car sort of stuff.
But it's not natural anymore. I think a lot of there's this perception now that everything, people take offence at everything they don't.
And so easy to take
offence. And I just don't think people take an intuitive approach to culture anymore. I think they're always second-guessing how their behaviour is going to
I don't know how people date or ever try and kiss a lady man or a man friend or whatever.
Because
you would be terrified.
My teenage sons, and I have no idea what they do or how they do it.
Do they sign contracts? I mean, really, stuff about consent and contracts.
I don't really ask them. But I mean, they haven't been in trouble so far.
But they take less risk.
Hopefully everything's fine. Nobody's been around to knock on the door going, do you know what's happened? But I know actually friends of mine who have had horrible experiences where their teenage son has been accused of some kind of sexual assault.
Yes.
And suddenly it goes into a police situation.
Awful. Yes.
And, it's awful, really.
Absolutely.
But we wonder why they're in their bedrooms and they're not out, like, taking risks and socialising because they are so afraid.
And it shouldn't be a risk, you're right. There should be a society where it's OK. Call out the appalling stuff.
Yeah, of course.
But actually allow people to interact in a way
but the difference is, Andrew, that there are some people who are younger than us, and I'm sorry to lump you in with me, who find some things appalling that you and I don't find appalling.
Oh, no, that's right. And it's interesting.
That's where we are.
What I love is a great example. On social media, a lot of people, we have a bit of banter between us.
I was being accused of bullying you.
No, it was lovely. Where are we? I love the people at home because they come to our defence and it's glorious. And thank you very much for that. But there's a bit of banter.
Yeah.
And this is what we've got to have. You've got to have a society where you can rib each other and tease each other.
Sure.
And it's not meant with offence. I always go back to intention. What is intended?
Yes.
If you don't mean to be offensive, you don't mean to do other bits and pieces, let people have banter.
But is the law also to blame here as well? Because there are you can find a lawyer now in this country. I mean, when I lived in America for 10 years, I used to say the bane of this country is that you can't do anything without a lawyer.
Mm. Yes.
You know, if you want to sign a lease for a flat, if you want to rent some office space, if you want to rent a car, you've got to sign legal documents. You've got to, and they won't let you sign them unless you've got a lawyer.
Yes.
And it's getting that way here. You can find a lawyer for anything now. Yes. And I think that has not...
I think that's a good step.
No, but it's not been helpful because lawyers clog up the works. They're not about common sense. They're about trying to build frameworks around you so that you don't do the wrong thing.
But to be fair, the good lawyers are those who talk about eventualities and say, whilst people are talking, here's what we would do in such and such a circumstance. You can then put that document away and just get on with life. Because actually, you've sorted out, while you're still talking, a sensible way of resolving it.
You don't need it written down, though. That's the point.
I think we've lost things like morals and good manners and upbringing, because when you start making everything into hate speech and a hate crime, what that comes down to is the fact that we don't have a basic level of a standard of decency within society that we can all adhere to.
Yeah, I absolutely agree.
And then you have to start making it into crimes.
And it becomes rigid. The more you write down and make it rigid, the less sort of
you don't want to prescribe life. But being brought up, I say, it's going back to the whole idea about treat people with respect.
Yes.
And you work on that sort of basis.
And
it's all right.
You have to be resilient. You have to be a bit, as Candice says, you have to be a bit more resilient.
Yes. Yeah.
If you're deeply offended by what someone says, sometimes you just have to be offended. Just turn it off.
Life is funny. Sometimes you need that release. You need that sort of banter.
Some people are just offensive.
Yes.
Don't talk to them.
Yeah.
Just move along. Yeah. Find somebody
else. They're idiots. They won't have any friends. Right.
But it was P.T. Barnum. P.T. Barnum, who always said, if you want to draw a crowd, start a fight.
Yes.
And that's what the media does. They play up these sort of relationships on that sort of basis. But we live in a society where there's all sorts of troubles going on, genuine troubles. Yeah. And I think these things are distracting.
They are.
The minor things basically nullify what are really, really serious issues.
Well, that's as nice as I've been to you for the whole show.
I know.
So it's going to stop now. Shut up now so that everybody else can have a chance to talk. Let's talk about motorways. The most ridiculously named smart motorways, the least smart thing I've ever met in my entire career as a journalist. Apparently, you won't be surprised to know, the technology breaks down quite a lot, like at least once a day.
These are terrifying, these roads. I was saying to Andrew, I remember as a child endlessly breaking down on motorways. Dad would get out the red triangle and put it up.
Right.
Middle of the night, you know, trying to change a tyre. And we would, you know, all the children in the car just wondering. Mm. The idea of being on a smart motorway, breaking down, not having a hard shoulder to pull onto. Maybe your lights have failed as well. Maybe the big end's gone. Do you remember that? The big end.
There's nothing worse than your big end going. I can
when
tell
you. When the big end goes.
Our fan belt was always going.
It really is.
You used to have to use your tights, didn't you?
Very scary. And as you say, the technology, the safety equipment is breaking down as well. And people really have no access to...
And I was looking at the list of things that they said that broke down. So no signs, signals, camera or radar at a particular junction 18 on the M6 for 5 days.
Yeah.
And the problem is, if you don't
then if they can't see that you're there, they can't
They go bang, right, right into the back of you. It's really, really dangerous.
But we're enthralled to technology all the time, and we always think technology is the solution. And oftentimes, it's not, especially when it breaks down. It's, you know, this is going to seem so petty, but it's like those fancy taps with sensors that that never work.
Yeah.
And it was just like the original technology that we had where you just turned on hot and cold.
Turn a tap on.
Worked perfectly.
Have you ever been in a hotel room and the lighting is so complicated that you spend about an hour trying to turn on the light over your bed and turn off the bathroom?
Yes.
You know, and I just think, give me a light switch.
That's what you want. Say. On and off. Boom, boom.
And you're on the same with televisions. You have about 20 remote controls. Yeah. You've got no idea.
No, I know.
What is going on?
Absolute and utter nightmare.
Yeah.
Now, let's talk about...
bring back the old days.
Bring back the old days. Sandwiches. Here's a good one.
Oh, I love this one.
The Sun have got this. and it's page 7. BLT, the best thing in sliced bread. So the BLT has apparently been voted the top 10, number one sandwich.
Yes.
Mm. It is good at BLT.
Oh, it's good.
Wonderful. I tell you what's not on the list, which I find surprising, is a salt beef sandwich.
Ooh, no.
With pickles and that sort of stuff, and with mustard.
That's good.
That is glorious. I find surprising at number three, equal third, is a fish finger sandwich. Do you like those?
I'm not a big fan. I don't mind fish fingers, but I don't like them in a sandwich.
Yeah.
But that's a very popular pub lunch,
isn't
it?
People put crisps inside sandwiches.
Yeah, well, that's a northern thing, isn't it?
Is that tasty?
No,
I any combination.
No, I think it's a very northern.
They deep fry Mars bars up there as well.
Deep fry Mars bars actually are terrific. They do taste very good. But yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan of an open sandwich.
Yes, that's good.
You know, or sort of a tuna with some melted cheese on it.
Oh, that's a winner, isn't
you
it?
You know, that's quite good.
The paninis and things like that.
Coronation chicken, I think, has had its day.
Oh, I'm not a fan.
Not one of those.
Well, I'm the only veggie on this panel. My favourite is grated carrot with hummus all over it in a sandwich. That's a really good one.
That's very refreshing.
To make it, but they don't anymore.
But coronation chicken was invented for the coronation, the same way they made a lemon posset.
Yeah, not this last one, the one before.
The one before, exactly.
That's why I think it's had its day. Back in your day, that was
back in my day. Oh, that's so offensive.
Thank you very much.
Now,
a boy has won some kind of competition.
Yes.
Doing a seagull impression.
That's amazing.
Oh, good.
3, 2, 1.
That's
brilliant.
9 years old.
I mean, this is what makes Britain great. I presume this took place in Britain.
Yes.
They're actually having a seagull impersonation.
I love it.
Competition. Why? I don't know.
92 out of 100 for his points.
Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah, very good.
All the adults. He did brilliantly. Apparently, he was inspired when a seagull stole his ham sandwich.
Yes.
Got into
I hope he went round and stole everybody's chips, because that would have been the perfect impersonation.
Yeah.
Worked on that sort of basis.
I mean, down in Hastings, which is not far from where I spend my weekends, it's terrifying in the summer. People come there, they have no idea.
They sit
outside.
Evil.
There's fish and chip shops everywhere. There's old fishing huts where people like to wander about, and there's genuine fishermen coming in. But there's so many seagulls, and they're huge. They're like this big.
They are.
And they will literally come and sit on the table where people are eating and just start eating.
Oh, no, they get more and more brave. Yeah. They work on that basis.
Yeah.
And they are huge, as
they're
you say.
They're massive, unbelievable. And also, they're very toxic. The stuff that they drop on the car, you want to get it cleaned, like, straight away.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you know...
But I love that little boy who not only did the noise, but he also had this glorious outfit as well.
Do you want to give us your seagull impression?
Is that right? What's that? It's more like an eagle, isn't it?
Kind of, I don't know what the eagle.
Do they not do that? Do they not do that?
Go on, Andrew.
Go on, then. Let's have your one.
That's all right.
That's a gorilla. That's a monkey.
South African seagull.
Go on,
well, in South Africa, the problems are baboons, actually.
That did sound more like a baboon.
It was a baboon.
Go on, Emma.
No. I have a career to think of. I have a career to think of.
She's not doing it. We've all got careers to think of. How do you think I got here? By doing impressions of rap.
That's very good.
Anyway, you're watching the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Coming up after the break, a just of all GPs been struck off, and the best from today's newspapers and tomorrow's stories as well. Don't you move.
I have a brilliant one.
Welcome back. You're watching the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Now, it's time for this.
The World of Woke.
So the Easter holidays are well and truly over, and so the petty protest movements that have become so endemic to our way of life have abated for the moment. But have no fear, the Just Stop All Brigade will be out in force once more before you can say May Bank Holiday. And the new kids on the block, Youth Demand, have barely worked out what their next move will be after getting nowhere fast in the last few weeks. The climate emergency, of course, demands it, as does the genocide in Gaza, as they call it. Just Stop Oil have already promised to spend the summer gluing themselves to airports, clambering onto planes and lying down on runways to disrupt the summer holidays of hardworking people in this country. They say they have to do it to raise awareness of the climate crisis, and no one sensible believes them. Their increasingly manic behaviour can only be explained by a kind of collective derangement syndrome. We know there are sons and daughters of the wealthy taking part. We've seen the nutty grannies that have joined in. But today, we have learned of a new cohort to the cause, actual grown-up people who have real jobs. How do we know? Ladies and gentlemen, I bring you the case of Dr. Sarah Benn, a bona fide GP who was arrested and jailed for taking part in 3 climate protests with Just Stop Oil in Kingsbury, North Warwickshire, in 2022. She took part in a sit-down protest at an oil terminal in breach of an injunction, which then led to her imprisonment. And now she faces being struck off as a doctor. The British Medical Association are crying that it's all so unfair. Well, breaking the law has consequences, and so it should have. A GP should surely know better and be more responsible. She spent 31 days in jail, and here's what she had to say. The climate crisis is the most significant existential threat to global health we have ever faced. In medicine, when an emergency is declared, immediate action is expected, not just words. We are trained as doctors to intervene decisively to avert tragedy. Therefore, this situation requires nothing less than decisive intervention. Well, perhaps Dr. Ben might want to address the actual health emergency in this country that would be the one where millions of people are waiting months and sometimes years for treatment on the NHS. Or she could help to reduce the number of people waiting over 2 weeks for a doctor's appointment by actually going to work instead of protesting illegally outside a bloody oil terminal. Given what she has said about the climate emergency, it seems pretty likely that she's going to protest again sometime soon or at any time in the future. And the NHS needs doctors that are dedicated to their medical work. You can do without people like her. Thanks very much. Go woke, go broke.
The world of woke.
The BMA, of course, very upset about this, saying, oh, you shouldn't strike off the doctor. She was just doing what she felt she believed in. Panel's back with me. Guys, I mean, if you go and break the law in any job, generally speaking, you lose your job, don't you?
Yeah, she's not being discriminated against for her political opinions.
Yeah. No.
She broke the law.
Yeah. Right.
And so there are consequences for that.
And discrimination works both ways. It's positive and negative. So if you look at the whole idea of the law is supposed to be blind and it's equal justice to everybody, and that has to be right.
Yes, but that's not the issue. The issue here is whether or not she gets struck off as a doctor by the Doctors Association or whatever it is. It's not the BMA, that's the union. But it's not the law that's striking her off. It is the professional organisation that monitors doctors. And if you're a doctor, if you break the law, you're out, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, so it's that consequence. So saying this is what your thing says, you've broken the law, there's the consequence.
Yeah.
As long as you've got clarity and it applies to everybody, that's why it's work on that sort of basis.
Yeah, I think so. And also, if you're a doctor, given the state of the NHS, and you're going to be in prison for 31 days and you're likely to do it again, because clearly, I mean, I'm sorry, people who are this obsessed with the climate emergency are not thinking rationally.
No.
You know, there's far more emergencies out there about people who are dying from cancer. We had cancer figures just this week, which have said that since lockdown, you know, the cancer waiting lists are getting longer, more people are getting into stage four cancer who shouldn't ever have got there. You know, that's a proper emergency. You know, not worrying about whether your bloody, you know, feet are going to get wet in a couple of thousand years.
It's real-life people, isn't it? And it's real-life, I don't know, older people living in pain with, you know, a hip operation that isn't going to be scheduled for another 2 years or something. It's so depressing when people go on about these.
Front page of The Sun, we've got the big picture that we mentioned earlier. Prince Louis flashing a cheeky smile, a photo taken by his mother to mark his sixth birthday. It's a sweet picture, isn't
it? It's a very sweet picture.
Looks and they say, like her.
And no Photoshop required.
Hey, very good.
Yeah. Also on the front page, Swiftie Guide to Taylor's London. Now, I've managed, I think, to get all the way through last week and this week without mentioning Taylor Swift. New album's out.
Amazing.
Talking
the
about
tortured
it.
The number, poets department.
The number of people in newspapers who are writing about this, you know, it's now become, if you're a columnist in this day and age, you have to write about Taylor Swift, whether it's about the revenge against your ex-boyfriend. This is about all the people who are flocking to this particular pub, I think, in
Her drawing power is amazing.
She isn't it? She's a remarkable
200
celebrity.
Million, I can tell you, within 24 hours of the Tortured Poets Department being released, had 200 million streams on Spotify.
Yeah.
Phenomenal.
Incredible.
She's got a billion-dollar era tour at the moment. And you're right, just mentioning this pub, the Black Dog, all of a sudden people are flocking in to go and see it.
Yeah. It is remarkable.
And this is a career that has lasted. I mean, she was famous as a very, very... successful country singer as a young teenager, wasn't she?
Yeah.
Named after
James
Taylor.
She's now in
her
30s.
Yeah.
She hasn't, you know, become any less popular as she's gone.
And if anything, she keeps reinventing herself. Yeah. And
I don't wish her ill, but I find her music so bland.
She loves your music.
And so boring. And I cannot imagine my teenage years being defined by Taylor Swift.
No, I think she's actually, I hate to say it, but I think her albums, her music's really good.
It's brilliant.
I think of Fleetwood Mac, I think of Alanis Morissette. I think of all these, like, cool female singers.
Yeah, but you see, the difference between, funnily enough, and the reason I know this is I read a piece today in the Times about different revenge songs, and Alanis Morissette's famous one.
Yeah. Jagged Little Pill.
Yeah, where she's really vitriolic and bitter about her ex-husband or her ex-boyfriend.
Yes.
Taylor Swift is a little bit more subtle about
it. She's nuanced,
you know,
doesn't
and
she?
And she's kind of... The reason the Black Dog comes up is because she's talking about this ex-boyfriend of hers who she said she saw his location because he'd gotten to switch his location off. So even though they'd broken up, she knew he was going there.
Yeah.
And that's why everyone's going there.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, maybe you're just too old for it, Cam.
Well, it's like the generational shift from, like, you know, old Hollywood. We had all these, like, wisecracking, brilliant female stars, and then you sort of went into the 1950s. And it was so bland.
Do you like Ed Sheeran? And it's a similar sort of thing with Ed.
No.
You don't like him either?
No, I don't like Ed Sheeran because he is bland. But I don't think Taylor Swift is bland. If you look at some of the lyrics that she writes, She's pretty vicious.
And she's incredibly influential. They had that stuff, you might remember, about Marsha during the, I think it was the midterms, wasn't it, in America. And they were turning out, she came out for the first time ever and talked about Trump in a wig, is what she called her.
Right. And she's also able to move the dial at football games.
Yes. You know,
more millions of people watch football games because she's there. It's quite ridiculous, but it's a thing.
Well, if her ex was at a pub in Vauxhall, maybe there's something else she needs to know about him.
Well, very much so. Well, Vauxhall's quite trendy for them. Some people. What about Diamond Weezer? In the
Oh, I love it.
Love this
great,
story.
Great old crime capers. Brian Reader, mastermind of the Hatton Garden heist, which actually I think you and I both thought was a lot longer ago.
Yes, it's only 2015.
I think I was getting it confused with Brink's Mac.
You were.
It was many decades ago in the 60s.
Yeah.
Hatton Garden was...
No, Brink's Mac was actually... No, Brink's Mac was kind of in the 80s.
The 80s.
Yeah.
Ronnie Biggs and that sort of stuff.
No, not Ronnie.
He was even earlier.
That was in the train.
Noy. Noy was Brink's
Mac. Kenny Noy was Brink's Mac,
Hatton Garden heist was 2015.
I know, amazing, isn't it? Amazing. And the film was 2017, I think, with Michael Caine. Didn't he play him?
But this guy's the mastermind of the heist. He's died at the age of 84.
Yes.
He takes to the grave, as they always say in these great newspaper stories, some of the secrets of the millions in missing
loot. Because
they never find the money.
He would sell on these stolen goods, and apparently he knew every inch of Hatton Garden. Isn't that amazing?
It is, of course.
Quite nimby. It's an amazing
place. All credit to the Sun writer who turned around, Diamond Weezer. Come on, we've got to recognise. There's always the pun is mightier than the sword. I love
Well, Mike Sullivan has been the crime editor of The Sun
for
many a decade, actually. And he knows all of these characters.
Right.
It's quite remarkable. Funnily enough, in the Brink's Mac thing, it was my one and only chance to get sent to Brazil. I was in America and I got sent because they captured somebody in Rio, and it wasn't Ronnie Biggs, it was Brink's Mac.
Yeah.
And I got down to Florida and I made the dreaded mistake, which you had to do in those days because we didn't have mobile phones, call the office. Called the office and they said, he's on his way to Miami, just stay where you are.
Oh, I was like, Michael should have carried on.
I wanted to go to Rio, I should have just got on the plane. You know, but that wasn't what you did in those days.
No.
There we are. Speaking of which, the 10 biggest mistakes you can make at the airport. I'm going to finish with this. Not booking parking, turning up too early, turning up too late, buying currency, not bringing a bottle, not weighing luggage. I mean, who needs this advice?
Turning up too late is a pretty basic error if you're trying to catch a flight.
You failed, number one.
But on the list, they're also saying buying duty-free is a mistake. That's rubbish, isn't it? People love to buy duty-free.
Well, it can be. It can be, depending on which airline you're flying.
Okay.
And that's the problem with it. But anyway, we haven't got time to get into it now. So I'm just going to bully you off the show. Thank you very much indeed to both of you. That's all for us tonight. You've been watching The Independent Republic and Mike Graham. I'll see you tomorrow at 8 p.m. sharp. Don't be late. Don't be early. It's only on Talk TV. Good night.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.